Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Public Broadcasting brings you gavel-to-gavel coverage of the state legislative session now underway. You can find coverage on our website at sdpb.org or sd.net. You can also download the State House podcast available wherever you get your podcasts. And today, we're joined for our Monday Journalist Roundtable by SDPB's Jackie Hendry. She's host of South Dakota Focus on SDPB-TV, and she's joining us from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB Sioux Falls space. Jackie, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, we have SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger. He's joining us from Pierre. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Seth Tupper is on assignment now. He'll be with us in hour two of the program. And Lee, I want to start with you because, of course, the latest, we're always watching for those COVID numbers, and COVID has returned to the Capitol with a positive test from a lawmaker. Tell me a little bit about what is unfolding.
Yeah, so Republican Representative, freshman Republican Representative Aaron Aylward of Harrisburg, Speaker of the House Spencer Gosch reached out to members of the House and said that Aylward had tested positive for COVID-19 and was basically telling members to monitor their symptoms. If you had a close contact, you can basically work remote until you get your test results back and that sort of thing. So this is the first reported case of COVID-19 in the Capitol since session started. We're starting week five now. It is finally entered the building, and we'll be keeping an eye on whether or not it's circulating among legislators and lobbyists and that sort of thing.
Since you've been spending these last 5 weeks in Pierre, tell us a little bit about screening when you enter the building, or how certain things have been handled with COVID precautions. What can you let us know?
Yeah, there's no COVID screening when you enter the building. There are various temperature monitors. They kind of look like a little tablet, and they're sitting outside of both the House and Senate chambers. You can stand in front of them, and it infrared beam, I suppose, basically says like what your temperature is.
Sure.
There are also some hand sanitizer stations sprinkled throughout the building. And then, of course, if you're a member of the public and you're in a Senate-controlled space, masks are required for you. And if you are within a House-controlled space, masks are strongly encouraged. State lawmakers are not required to wear those masks. And so that's kind of the protocol of the building right now as it sits.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask, too, about there's events that happen outside the building as well. Do we know anything about Representative Aylward and his connections, his close contacts, or his whereabouts? What is being shared at this point?
We don't at this point. I mean, obviously, there are events that sort of unfold outside of regular business inside the state capitol. Also, this weekend was the GOP party, state party elections. I'm working on confirming whether or not Aylward was in attendance. Again, all we know thus far is that he tested positive on Sunday morning. And
sure.
I asked Speaker of the House sort of what, Speaker of the House Spencer Gosch, sort of what changes, if anything. And again, he said, if anybody's showing symptoms, they should get a test. It's worth pointing out that lawmakers are getting tested. It's not clear how many are or how many tests are being done, but that is available for legislators if they want those. And up until this point, those results have been coming back negative. And Gosch says that they will keep pushing on as planned. And I think the plan will sort of shift if need be.
Sure. All right. Well, let's talk about some of that pushing on, because the legislation attempting to block people from changing their sex designation on their birth certificate, making those birth certificate amendments, it's been through quite a an interesting route, but it has been once again defeated. Tell us a little bit of where the procedure is at this point with that bill.
Yeah, so it came up on... Oh, geez. The register here is starting to go off.
Jackie Hendry, stand by. This register is...
For context, I'm underneath the Capitol steps in the press room, and there's a very old register that likes to click. So
we're gonna put a pin in that.
Gives that sense of space.
We're gonna bring Jackie Hendry into the conversation. Tell us a little bit about what you're keeping track of this week, please.
All right. Sorry about that. That just gave me the giggles.
That's a good time. Yeah.
poorly. We do have a show this week. As I mentioned last week, I've been paying a lot of attention to Senate Bill 66. That was the bill to allow Ocheti Shekoi community-based schools centered on the Ocheti Shekoi Essential Understandings. That's a set of curriculum made available through the State Department of Education website, focused on language, histories, identity, culture, a whole host of topics related to the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people of this region. So this bill passed the Senate unanimously last year, did not see the same level of support this year, and that bill has been defeated in the Senate as of last Thursday. But we are continuing the conversation because it's based in an issue that has been longstanding, and there's still folks wanting to make a change.
Lee, I want to jump in with some of this other ag tax legislation that we're looking at, because it's also pretty important, and we're just starting to kind of understand what's happening here. So tell us a little bit about some of the early conversations about ag taxes.
Sure. The larger conversation about ag taxes took place last year and has taken place over the last several years. This particular bill is a bill, it's called House Bill 1085, and it kind of redefines sort of smaller parcels of land and those being used as ag tax. And so there's a lot of concern out there among the Dakota Rural Action, and also some of these like smaller sort of, think of them as kind of like farmers market farmers. The bill kind of says that you have to in three of the previous 5 years, in order to be classified as ag, you have to make at least $2,500 from the pursuit of agriculture from that land. And then also there's like a minimum acreage requirement of this certain subdivision has to be greater than 160 acres. So it's really kind of changing ag tax for some of these sort of smaller farmers. But then there's also an interesting side effect from this bill also that has folks up in the Black Hills kind of concerned. Yesterday I spoke with Bill Coburn, who is the current chair of the South Dakota Family Forests, and recently retired, has been an industrial forester for 40 years. And that group that he is chair of is the only non-governmental organization that represents forest landowners in South Dakota. They have 110 members thus far, and kind of what they do is they help people manage their properties and help produce timber for the timber industry, which in turn, kind of benefits sort of keeping the forest clean and fire resistant. Coburn said that the minimum acreage requirement of $160 of 160 acres, 80% of their members wouldn't meet that category. And also the income restrictions really create a problem for some of these family forest folks. The income that comes off of forest land is a little bit different than corn and wheat. Coburn said you can count on a good harvest every 20 years. So proving, three out of every 5 years that you make $2,500 a year is a little bit tough, And Coburn said this, along with another bill, is really a poison pill for their membership.
That's going to force a lot of these guys to have to contemplate selling their property and breaking it up into smaller lots, like, you know, 2 and 5 acre lots, which I don't think is what a lot of people in the Black Hills want to see, is to have subdivisions throughout the Black Hills in these smaller forested parcels. So,
and real quick, another thing that he said was, you know, that means the Black Hills could get developed really fast. It's already a pretty developed area, and that forest fragmentation could have an impact on wildlife habitat. It would increase wildland urban interface issues, and then firefighting and forest management could really get complicated because of that. You know, and Coburn says that their group was not reached out to about these bills, and he's not sure why the legislature is pushing it at this point.
So help me understand, just for clarity. So if you own a certain patch of land and this legislation goes forward, then you might have to sell it off because you can't afford to keep it because of the potential redesignation of what that land is for. And the fear is, once you sell it off, you have people who are going to come in and do other things to it other than, you know, manage it like these landowners have done. That's kind of the general concern, right? Do I understand it correctly?
Yeah, and you know, to be fair, the Department of Revenue has said that there are, well, I'll step back even further. Taxes is obviously a lot less than residential and commercial.
Okay, sure.
To be fair, the Department of Revenue testified in favor of this bill, and they basically have said that based on recent changes to ag tax policy in the state, that there are some people out there, and I've reached out for how common of an occurrence that this actually is that some people will create an entity or an LLC and get a couple Angus cows and basically create do some creative financing to qualify a parcel of land for ag status, and sure, this bill is aimed at sort of closing a loophole and keeping intact what they call limited transactions to qualify for ag status.
So
there's these two intersections of that kind of at play right now.
So that's what they're trying to get at, and that's some of the concerns about development, is, you know, especially in the Black Hills. But I'm also wondering, Lee, about, as we kind of figure out what's happening with marijuana legislation in the state and some people who might be interested in starting smaller grow operations or for industrial hemp, is this kind of legislation and ag tax also perhaps going to collide with some of those efforts?
It's certainly something that will be talked about. I think Representative Tim Goodwin, when they were debating it on the House floor, said, hey, we need to take a step back here and wait to see what happens. And I think there's also going to be a real hard debate about whether the state considers that farming or not. And so this would, you know, conceivably, if you put up a greenhouse on your property or a parcel of land and want to designate that area as ag tax, and it, you know, obviously it's not a 160 acre greenhouse, but, you know, and then right. And then comes the question of how much money you make off of it as well. So a lot of things at play here for sure.
Interesting. Speaking of that, as the lawsuits sort of proceed for Amendment A, are we seeing lawmakers figure out what some of the legislation that would cover recreational marijuana and growth and industrial hemp in the state? Like, are you seeing stuff come through already?
So it's gonna take maybe a week or two more before we really start to see the bulk of marijuana legislation coming through. So to answer your question, yes, we are seeing that. There is a bill out there already that Rapid City Republican Representative Mike Derby is bringing that essentially codifies the retail portion of Amendment A. But if Amendment A is overturned in the courts, it's immediately repealed. There's also a nice little section up above it that's like, we do not endorse the sale. The legislature does not endorse the sale of marijuana and those sorts of things. So they're really basically saying, this is to follow the intent of the voters. There's also some banking bills that are in the works, and another bill that would penalize people for driving while smoking marijuana. But there are also several vehicle bills that are empty at this point. So I think the legislature is still trying to get its feet set on this before we really start seeing that happen.
So you were talking about driving, and then you said vehicle bills, and they're not related. So
they are not related.
For listeners who don't know what a vehicle bill is, explain that from a procedural standpoint.
Yeah. So okay. So every bill, if a bill is amended, it's essentially an empty shell bill.
Sure.
And it says this, a common one would be, this is a bill to enhance South Dakota. Others have said a bill to provide for marijuana of some kind, let's say.
Yeah.
And so it has a topic, and the subject of the bill has to meet the original intent of the title. And so that's why you see all these empty bills that just say, you know, for provisions dealing with marijuana. They'll get amended with something called a hog house. It's like the actual legislation that legislators want. It's just not written yet, and it's just kind of a procedural move to keep bills in play as they have to cross chambers and sort of to basically kind of figure this out later on in the session as they're dealing with it.
Meet those timelines when the time comes.
Yes.
All right, Jackie, I'm going to bring you back in the conversation. Let's go back to Ochechi Shakouin a little bit and the work that you're doing for South Dakota Focus this Thursday. Where do you want to jump in where we left off here?
Right. Well, I want to lead off with something that I'm embarrassed that I didn't know. So I'm going to make sure that other people also know it when we have these conversations about the Ochechi Shakouin Essential Understandings. That's that curriculum that we mentioned before. This week we're going to lead off the program with a bit of an interview that I had with Joe Moran. He's Director of Policy and Strategic Initiatives for the State Department of Education. And I have been operating under this understanding, and I think a whole lot of other people have, that these essential understandings are not required pieces of South Dakota curriculum. That actually isn't the case. And so here's a clip from that interview where Joe Moran explains a bit of where that misconception comes from.
No, these standards are required across the board. Any set of standards that we have posted officially have gone through the review process of the Board of Education standards. And they do set in codified law the requirement of those standards within the school. There is difficulties around measuring that with when you get into discussions of assessments and such, especially with something such as Native Indigenous language and culture, a very, very difficult measurement, and something that we aim to work with our tribal partners in understanding more about how we get there.
So these standards, they are required, yes, but there isn't really a mechanism yet for the Department of Education to really grasp just how these standards are being implemented in schools, and they're still figuring out how to test for it.
Interesting. Now, have you looked closely at the standards themselves? I mean, when we say language, I guess the first question is, should every K through 12 student come out with some kind of understanding of language as well?
I'm scrolling down the PDF right now. So when we talk about like culture and language, I think it comes down to identifying some similarities and differences among the different dialects between Lakota, Dakota, Nakota languages. Being able to recall certain sacred sites and creation stories for that cultural knowledge, and describing some of the efforts made by tribal members to revitalize Ochechi Shakouin languages. So, for instance, Lakota, one of the people who testified in favor of this bill, Sage Fastog, he is leading a Lakota immersion school on the Rosebud Reservation. During part of his committee testimony, he talked about the fact that Lakota is on track to be an extinct language within a decade. So that's a bit of that piece of that standard.
All right. Who else do you have for us to hear today before we let you go?
All right. Let's move to last Thursday, the Senate floor debate. This bill had been brought back to life to be reconsidered. A couple slight amendments to change some words to in the hopes of making this bill more palatable to folks who were concerned about local control issues and things like that. But the bite I'm going to play for you is from Senator Jean Hunhoff of District 18 in Yankton. She Was opposed to this bill, and she gives a long explanation, starting with in 2016, the legislature had approved $2 million for Native American grant schools to address some of the concerns that this bill also wants to address, like relatively low graduation rates for Native American students and low test scores and things like this. So here's a chunk of Senator Hunhoff's arguments on the Senate floor.
My point is this. We gave them an opportunity, and I think it demonstrated that it did work. It worked in their school system. So now to come back and say, oh, you know, that wasn't, everybody left, and I don't know the reasons for that, but we've got to try something else. I mean, that was the idea. That was the pilot to give it the opportunity. So I'm going to ask you to vote no, because I think they've demonstrated that pilot and why we can't continue and develop and work in the school system the way that it was implemented at that point in time with some positive results. I think that sets the stage for us, and I would hope they continue in that.
Now, Senator Hunhoff is correct. The results from those Native American grant schools were very positive. Test scores went up. Attendance went up because those schools were able to find ways to incorporate these Ocheti Shikoni standards and make curriculum more relevant, keep students in the classroom. But what she misses is a part of why those programs did not continue based off those that grant program. So here's a quick bite from Sage Fastog. He's a member of the Todd County School Board and holds a whole lot of other titles. He was part of the leadership in that grant school in the Todd County School District. And here's what he told the Senate Education Committee about why that grant program didn't continue.
We were on track to take our model to the entire district. However, like any grant, once the funding goes, so does the program.
So this is what's missed in Senator Hunhoff's argument that we had set up this pilot program. The funding didn't pull through.
Yeah. One more. Yeah.
Right.
Heiner.
Yeah. So we have then other senators went on saying, oh, this school district is doing something with these standards. This school district is doing something. Senator Jack Kolbeck talking about the Sioux Falls School District just the day before having a meeting to discuss how to insert these standards more regularly. But here's a piece of Senator Troy Hinart of Mission, his closing statements on this bill that he sponsored.
We've heard a lot today. I appreciate the passion my good friend from Sioux Falls. But in his testimony, he said, yesterday we met. The data that you have all seen that I passed out, that wasn't a year in the making. That has been 40 years, if not longer, in South Dakota. Statewide data, 53% Native kids graduate on time. Are you okay with those numbers? That's what we have to ask ourselves. That's 37% difference than their friends that they go to school with. Is that because our kids can't learn? No. It's because the system somehow has become irrelevant to them.
So this bill didn't end up failing on the Senate floor, but we're going to continue this conversation on South Dakota Focus this week about needs in education for Native students. Senator Hinart is going to be one of our guests, along with Sarah Pierce of the South Dakota Education Equity Coalition, also has been part of this movement in favor of these Ocheti Shikoni schools. And we're working on scheduling an interview with Dr. Lori Simon, the superintendent of the Rapid City Area Schools, who spoke in opposition to this bill, saying there's a possibility to create what's called a magnet school already within the Rapid City School District, and that this legislation isn't necessarily needed. So that conversation continues on Focus this week.
Really powerful testimony there. Nobody should be okay with those numbers in any way, shape, or form. Jackie Hendry, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Lee Sturbinger, thanks so much as well.
Yeah, you bet.